Genesis 10:32. These are the families of the sons of Noah, according to their genealogies, by their nations. And out of these, the nations were separated on the earth after the flood. There are over 3 billion people on planet Earth, many different races, tongues, and nations. Yet as we have read in Genesis chapter 10, we are in fact one global family. Consider with me this morning that there is just one global family. Consider also the main trouble with our global family, and then finally the great need of our global family. Firstly, there is just one global family. The science of ethnology, which is the study of the races of men, bears out the close relationship that we all have with one another. We may be interested in talking about blue blood, in tracing our line and our roots, but when it really comes down to it, we find that we are all part of this family called human beings, whatever color, whatever race, whatever nation. Talking about pure races and tracing one's line, I heard or read somewhere that there is in fact only one real pure race on earth. Do you know what that is? Or who they are? It's some native tribe in Africa. Really the only pure race. Why the rest of us are like Hyde's 57 variety. And yet we're all one great global family. As a student of ancient Near Eastern history, I used to be able to study and was interested in observing how one could trace the history of a people and their relationship with other countries just by studying the language of a country. For example, in the Semitic language, one can see the beginning of the traces of a Semitic language with a language called Akkadian in the middle of the 3rd millennium BC. And then one can trace that lineage into a language called Ugaritic into the middle of the 2nd millennium BC. And then one can trace that lineage into Hebrew, into the Iron Age, the 1st millennium BC, until finally we have Aramaic. And it's just fascinating to discover how one can relate all the families of the earth in the Middle East by simply studying language, linguistics. Did you know that our English alphabet is based upon the Latin alphabet? That the Latin alphabet is based upon the Greek alphabet? That the Greek alphabet is based upon the Phoenician alphabet, that the Phoenician alphabet is based upon a Semitic, that is Hebrew alphabet? Why, it only bears out what you and I are closer to the people. I know we like to talk about our lineage, tracing it from Europe, but it only bears out that we're closer to even the people of the Middle East than we think. But Genesis 10 also bears out that there is just one global family, and that's what I'm pointing out. The science of ethnology bears it out, and so does Genesis 10. That's what this text means to say. In verse 1 we read, Now these are the records of the generations of Shem and Ham and Japheth, the sons of Noah. And sons were born to them after the flood. There's just one family of men on earth. And then Genesis 10 goes on to talk about what are these different families. And let me just point out some of the more important features to you by looking at this text. There are three main divisions or families of the earth according to Genesis 10. Now, Genesis 10 doesn't trace all the families or the races of the earth. But it does suggest that all the families and the races come from these three peoples, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. In verses 2 through 5, we have the line of Japheth. And there is a list of names there, Gomer and Magog and Madai and all the other names that are mostly hard to pronounce. I'm glad I took Hebrew, if for no other reason that I can pronounce the names or come close to it in reading the Bible. But the line of Japheth were those who are now called the Indo-Europeans. They settled mostly around the northern Mediterranean, went up into Greece, into Asia Minor, and on up into Europe, so that Europeans and Americans are more or less the descendants of the line of Japheth. And then it says, beginning in verse 6, and the sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. And here we have those who settled to the east, to the south of the Middle East. For example, Cush is mentioned here. Cush has been identified as more or less that area of Ethiopia. Regardless, it was to the south. We meet it again in Numbers 12, where it says that Aaron and Miriam murmured against Moses because Moses took for a wife a woman who was a Cushite woman. The implication is that she was an Ethiopian, and they objected to Moses having taken her for a wife. You know the outcome of the story, and if you don't, then you can read it for yourself in the book of Numbers. That's not our point. I'm just pointing out that these people settled to the south of the Middle East. Then there is also the mention of Mizraim. Mizraim is the Hebrew name for Egypt. So there are the Egyptians. And then Put and Canaan. Canaan was the one who was cursed. Look back up in chapter 9, verse 25. Where Canaan, that is the son of Ham, had done something, made fun of his father when his father was drunk and naked. And therefore, when Noah waked up, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants, he shall be to his brothers." Now, we didn't have time last Lord's Day to get into the matter of the curse of Canaan and what that meant. Because there is an interpretation of Genesis 9:25 which would have us believe that here God has put a curse of subservience upon all the black nations of the earth. Now, I hope and trust that I don't need to say that that is something short of an abomination to conclude that. It's terrible exegesis. It's not even reading the text for what it says. And I hope that you and I, as Southerners, have gotten beyond our prejudices along that line. Now, I can say that I'm not from New Jersey. I'm not from Iowa. I am more south in the mouth than you are. I'm from South Alabama. There was no one, I don't think I felt, as prejudiced as I myself was, having been raised in segregation, having been raised to think a certain way, I was prejudiced too. And it wasn't until God taught me what the meaning of love was that He delivered me from that. And I hope that we as Presbyterians, that we as members of the First Presbyterian Church of Gadsden, Alabama, as Christians are beyond a kind of prejudice that would lift out text of Scripture like this in order to demonstrate that there is a people on the earth meant to be the servants of other peoples. That is not the implication of this text, because one reason, and I want to remind you or point it out to you, is that Ham, that is the descendants of Ham, who in fact did go down into Africa, the descendants of Ham, or all the descendants of Ham, are not cursed, but the line of Canaan. The line of Canaan wasn't even the black line. The line of Canaan was that line settled right around the Middle East. So I trust that we have dispelled that false interpretation of Genesis 9:25. Let me say, by way of application, you can't hate people and love God at the same time. That's a hard lesson for all of us to learn, isn't it, Christian? And then there's a line of Shem, beginning in verse 21, going through 31, the line of Shem of the Semitic peoples. Notice that in chapter 9, verses 26 and 27, Noah blesses the God of Shem. And then in verse 27, he says, "May God enlarge Japheth and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." What he is pointing out is that all the peoples of the earth will somehow be blessed in the line of Shem. That is the line of the Semites, the line of the Jews. In fact, he points out that in verse 21 of chapter 10, he says, "And also to Shem, the father of all the children of Eber." Eber is the Hebrew way of saying in English, Hebrews. Those were the Hebrew people. But let me say something by way of application. We've just been pointing out some biblical truths. But let me make these two applications immediately, and we're still talking about our one global family, and you see how the Bible approaches it, that we are related to everybody. The first application is this: God, that is the God of the Bible, is in control of all history. The book of Proverbs says that the heart of the king is in the hand of God, and that He turns it whithersoever He pleases. That is, everything is in God's hand. And in Genesis 10, we see God, who is the author of the dispersion of peoples around the earth. But then I want you to note, in Paul's sermon to the Greek intellectuals on Areopagus in Athens, in Acts 17, verse 26, he says, "And He made," that is God, "made from one every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation." That says that the God that we worship is a God who has established the races, the peoples, the nations, the boundaries of those who dwell on earth. We sometimes hear it said that we are all worshiping the same God, that we're all trying to get to the same place. Whether He is called the Supreme Being, as there are some clubs and organizations and or religions that refer to the God of the universe as the Supreme Being, or whether they say we call Him Allah, or whatever, it's all the same God. But that is not the biblical picture. The biblical picture is 1 Timothy 2:5, which says there is one God and one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus. The way of the Supreme Being is not the way. The way of Allah, Islam, is not the way. There is only one way, and that is through the way of Christ, the God of the Bible, by which a man may be saved. But there is another application that I want to point out, and it is this. The record of the Bible intends to teach real history. You see, the first application is that God is in charge of all of history. But the second application is this. The record of the Bible intends to teach real history. That is why the Bible goes to such effort and lengths to record the lives of men on earth. Now, Genesis 10 is not a precise genealogy. I hope you gathered that. Because often Genesis 10 is referring not to individual people, but sometimes it's referring to entire people, sometimes entire nations. So God is, as it were, with one broad stroke of the brush, saying that here I started it all, and now all the peoples and the nations of the earth come from this. But it is history. There was a man in another church in another city who visited that church, and he said, I want to join. Someone from that church went to visit that man and began to talk with him, and they found out that that man didn't really believe that the Bible was even history, that Jesus was even real. He said, oh, well, it's religion, isn't it? As if religion is some kind of myth, as if the religion of the Bible were a myth. But the Bible intends to teach real history, and that's what our point is. There is a historical accuracy to the Bible. As a student of archaeology, anyone can see that there has not been one contradiction to the Bible that has ever emerged from archaeology. The greatest mind, perhaps, in the 20th century in the study of the Bible was William Foxwell Albright, who headed the Department of Ancient Near Eastern History at Johns Hopkins. He began a skeptic as he studied ancient Near Eastern history, but as he began to study history and archaeology and compare it with the Bible, he discovered how accurate, how true, how precise and reliable Scripture really is. But also the historical nature of the Bible is proven by the New Testament. Jesus thought it was history. The writers of the New Testament thought it was history. And friends, if it is not history, then the Bible is not an accurate record. Then what must we say about Jesus and his teaching? But the point is that we're dealing with real history. Creation is real. Adam and Eve were real people. The flood was real. Noah was real. And these nations of the earth are real people. History. The point is this. The point that I am making in this first point is this. It points out the fact that we are one global family on this earth. That we're all related to one another. And this is what the Bible is saying. Let's hurry to the second point. The main trouble with our global family is pointed out in verses 8 and 9 of chapter 10. And I'll tell you right out, the main trouble is man's independence from God. Look at verse 8. It says, now Cush became the father of Nimrod. He became a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. I believe there is some hunting equipment called Nimrod, a camper or boat or something, Nimrod. You see where they get the name. Nimrod, mighty hunter before the Lord. He seemed to be a man's man. But unfortunately, he was more than that. You see, Nimrod was the son of Cush. Who was Cush from? Cush was from the line of Ham. What happened to the line of Ham? They were cursed by God up in chapter 9. And you know what I think we have in verses 8 and 9 of Genesis 10? I think we have a clear example of this, like father, like son. I think Ham resented the fact that he was cursed. And he passed on his resentment to his son Cush. And Cush passed on his resentment to his son. And he named his son Nimrod. Do you know what Nimrod means? Let us rebel. Let us rebel, Nimrod. The word hunter may also be translated tyrant. That he was a mighty tyrant. And the word before may also be translated against, as if to say this man Nimrod, who was to be admired in many ways, was a man who was set up against God. Man's independence from God. That is his main trouble in our global family. Let's go to the second main trouble, and it is this: man's domination of man. Look, read on in chapter 10, verses 10 through 12, and we see that Nimrod the tyrant, the man who was openly defiant before God, began to establish and rule over men as he set up all these cities. A man to be admired. He reminds me of Sargon the Great, the first great empire builder of Mesopotamia, the king of Sumer and Akkad, the lord of the four regions. He reminds me of Charlemagne and of Napoleon, of Caesar, of Robert the Bruce of Scotland, who was able to take all the warring clans and create a nation of Scottish people. And so here's Nimrod, a man among men, a man of great influence. But basic to his nature was something that is basic to ours, and it is this. It is illustrated in the game that we boys used to play called the King of the Hill. You see a mound or a hill, and somebody goes and he stands on top of it, and he dares anybody to come knock him off. Nimrod display the basic nature of you and me, and that is we desire to dominate and rule and control and manipulate other people. Perhaps this was a good emotion initially. I mean, perhaps Nimrod and his desire to dominate was an emotion where he wanted to excel and to be the best he could, but now it exemplifies the desire to control men and to beat men and to be the Lord and the King. Now, we don't say that in our society. I think we have sophisticated it, though, and we call such men leaders, or we call them men of influence, who can control other men. I wonder if God is as impressed as we are with leaders and men of influence. I believe there is a prayer, isn't it? It goes like this: Oh Lord, save us from what men do to men in the name of goodness. I mean, kings have chopped off the head of their subjects in the name of God. They thought they were doing deity a favor by doing it. And so, the second main problem with our global family, the first is his desire to be independent of God. The second is his desire to dominate other men, as exemplified in Nimrod. What I'm saying is that let's not institutionalize the spirit of Nimrod into either accepting someone's leadership, however well-meaning it is appearing to be. Need I but remind you of Jim Jones and the Guyana tragedy? Nor let us accept the spirit of Nimrod by practicing the proverb, we better do it unto him before he does it to us. One-upmanship. My desire to control you and to be one step ahead of you before you can do something to me. You see, if your heart, if your own individual heart, and if our government is characterized by either the spirit of a desire to be independent from God, or to dominate over men, then our fate is sealed. I know I'm speaking generally at this point, but my burden is specific, and my heart is heavy for the peoples called Americans and our country. I wonder that we can put on our coins, in God we trust, and at the same time ban prayer from our public schools. I wonder that we can prevent the teaching of biblical creationism alongside evolutionism and say that we're a nation under God. Is not your heart burdened? The first president of our United States said this: it is impossible rightly to govern the world without God and without the Bible. But finally and lastly, the great need of our global family. I said the great problem was man's independence from God and man's desire to dominate over men. But the great need is this. It is simply to love one another as fellow men. Does that sound naive or an oversimplification? To love your neighbor? If it sounds that way, then I remind you that it is not a preacher who says it, but it was the Son of God who articulated, and God in His law who said, love your neighbor as yourself. That is the great need of our global family, is it not? That same man who said it then accepted the spitting, the abuse, and the mocking until he carried a cross up Calvary's mountain and he demonstrated to us what true love in fact is. And then he says to us, love as I have loved you. There was a popular phrase at the end of the last century and the beginning of this, and it was called the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, the progress of the human race onward and upward forever. Doesn't that sound naive? After two world wars, after the extermination of 9 million Jews, after the extermination of some 17 to 30 million Russians during the reign of Stalin, after legalized extermination of children yet unborn. It sounds mighty naive to me. Bible-believing Christians rejected the notion. And yet there is a truth in it, and it is this: that we are of one brotherhood as creatures of God who have been created, and we are to love one another. As the song says, what the world needs now is love, sweet love. Who cannot help but feel compassion for the peoples of Poland? or Afghanistan, or the Kyrgyz people in Bangladesh, chased out of their environment, had to settle as refugees there, desiring just to go to Alaska to have some freedom. I've been praying for them. Have you? Who cannot be affected, but be affected by the fact that as you and I go home today and we sit down to our table of roast beef and English peas and rolls and butter, that some 440 million people on the earth will not even have the minimum requirement of food today. Who cannot but be affected by it? And then Jesus taught us how to love. He told the story about the Good Samaritan. God loves like that. Will you bear the burdens of people in Gadsden and people in Alabama who can't even read? Are you burdened that our illiteracy rate is one of the highest in our nation to teach these people? To love your neighbor. That's the great need of our global family. It's the great need to love them enough to invite them into the family of God. Did you wonder why Genesis 10 was in the Bible? I mean, read it. I mean, it's dry and it's dull. The reason that it is there, I believe, is because it's one of the greatest missionary chapters in all the Bible. Because it pictures the scattering of the peoples of the earth, and then it is fulfilled. They are regathered all the way in Acts 2, in the first gospel sermon that was ever preached. There were people from all over the world in Jerusalem, and Paul was preaching, and some 3,000 people were gathered from every nation and tongue and tribe into a new humanity and to a new race of people, and that new race of people is called the Church of Jesus Christ. You see, Jesus said, "He who does not gather with me scatters." That means that if our church, if the First Presbyterian Church of Gadsden, Alabama, is not a gathering church, then, beloved, we are a scattering church. The alternatives are two: that we may gather the peoples of the world, of Gadsden, of Alabama, around the world, and demonstrate that love to them. Will you pray with me, oh God? Will you set the world in my heart and then set my heart aflame with the love of Jesus Christ? Love your neighbor as yourself and love him enough to invite him into the family of God. Let us stand for the closing prayer and benediction.